From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a former co-worker talks about the Michigan judge in the running to become a nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think everyone from across the country should embrace a judge like Judge Kaplitz. He's this kind of principled, thoughtful, intelligent jurist that the country needs.
Could doing a better job recycling aluminum and steel help cushion us from trade wars and tariffs?
The amount the U.S. fails to recycle internally is about equal to the amount it imports.
The Frederick Meyer Gardens awaits this week's blooming of its corpse plant. The first time in 18 years a plant they call Putricia is bloomed.
It will open up and it will be quite wide, and it will be a maroon color inside, and it will smell of rotting flesh.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tonight at 9 p.m., President Trump will announce his pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, a replacement for retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Among the four names said to be still on the president's shortlist is Raymond Kethledge, who has served on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati for the past 10 years. We have been hearing about Judge Kethledge's Michigan roots. He moved here when he was in high school. He has undergrad and law degrees from the University of Michigan. He still lives in Michigan. But let's get a better sense of just who he is as we welcome someone who has known Raymond Kethledge and shared an office with him. Christopher Yu is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you shared an office with Raymond Kethledge when you were both clerking for retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. When was that?
That was 1997 to 98. We actually not only shared an office, we shared a number of other experiences. I'm actually born in Michigan, raised in Tennessee. Tennessee, I being part of the Sixth Circuit, the same circuit that Judge Kethledge now oversees. And actually, we were one of only two of the three clerks that had children during the clerkship years. So we shared many special bonds.
So tell us what it was like working alongside him.
Without question, Judge Kethledge was one of the most respected clerks from our term. He has a razor-sharp legal intellect, a wonderful writing style that has earned praise from around the country by judges as being perhaps the best writing style in the entire federal judiciary. But most importantly to me, has a down-to-earth, common guy-next-door sensibility to him that I always really appreciated.
Now, when President George W. Bush nominated him to the federal appellate court, Judge Kethledge was only 41, one of the youngest ever. Did it surprise you at all he made it to the federal appellate bench at that age?
It's not that unusual. I guess Justice Kennedy himself, when he was nominated to the appellate bench in the Ninth Circuit, was 38 years old. So in a sense, it's quite common. The unusual thing to me was Judge Kethledge, instead of choosing to stay in Washington, D.C., and accept one of the very lucrative offers he no doubt received, he chose to go back to Michigan. And in terms of setting yourself up for a judicial appointment, in some ways, spending a little more time in D.C. might have had some advantages. But I think his heart's always been back in Michigan. He always wanted to go home.
Now, he's been described as a no-frills judge. What does that mean from your point of view?
I think he's very plain-spoken and direct. If you read his opinions, they're not filled with legalese. They're written in a way to be accessible to people who just are interested citizens and want to know what the courts are doing. He's been described in the press as not mincing words. But in addition, you know, I mean, one of the things that always got me is he was always had a very down-to-earth quality. I remember he often makes a comment about someone, and this isn't a compliment, who doesn't mind drinking beer straight out of the bottle is the kind of person he values. It's someone who doesn't really put on a lot of pretension or a lot of airs, but has a down-to-earth quality about them.
And through the years, you've seen his decisions, you've read his writings. Tell us, how do you feel that he interprets laws and the U.S. Constitution?
I think he interprets the laws of the U.S. Constitution in the way we would hope a jurist would, taking the words of the Constitution seriously, giving great respect to Supreme Court precedent, but really taking each case on its own terms, understanding the particular facts and the arguments presented, and really giving a fair hearing to litigants who are before the court. You'd like to have someone with an open mind, but yet a principled approach where if they come to the conclusion that a particular result is the right one, they will stick to it, even if inevitably someone's not going to be very happy about it. And that's often the case with judging. One way or the other, someone's not going to be happy about it. And I think that he brings together a wonderful combination of respect for the Constitution, respect for precedent, and an awareness that it is for Congress to make decisions in many cases and not the courts, and to try to find the right balance within our system of government.
Judge Kethledge co-authored a book about the benefits of solitude titled Lead Yourself First. And he makes this case about finding uninterrupted time to think, to kind of work things out in your head. How does that fit with the man that you knew and worked with?
It fits beautifully. To me, Judge Kethledge has always enjoyed fly fishing, and often on his free days would go walk streams and just be casting about with his own thoughts. And I think all of us know how crowded our lives have become. And we become aware that that kind of time for reflection and real thoughtfulness has become critical and all too rare in this day and age.
This pick, Professor Yu, has a lot of people excited and a lot of people nervous. It kind of depends on where one falls on the ideological spectrum. Clearly, Judge Kethledge has the support of many conservatives. From what you know of the man, what is there to like for those who lean left, those who are concerned about the possibility of a number of longstanding Supreme Court precedents being overturned?
I think everyone from across the country should embrace a judge like Judge Kethledge. He's this kind of principled, thoughtful, intelligent jurist that the country needs.
University of Pennsylvania law professor Christopher Yu, we want to thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today.
It's my pleasure.
This is a pretty momentous week at the Frederick Meyer Gardens in Grand Rapids. Their once tiny corpse flower is now a strapping grown-up, and it's about to bloom for the very first time. Wendy Overbeck is Senior Horticultural Manager at Frederick Meyer Gardens. Wendy, how long have you had this plant?
We have had the plant for 18 years now.
And it was in a little tiny 4-inch pot when it arrived all those years ago?
It was. Yep, it was just a little seedling.
And how tall is it now?
Today, the bloom measures at almost 4.5 feet.
Now, when you say the bloom measures, is that the whole stalk plus bloom? I guess I'm trying to visualize that.
It doesn't really have much of a stalk. It's almost all flower. The flower in total is about 4.5 feet tall, and the base of that flower kind of rests at the soil level.
Okay, and it has bloomed.
It's in the process of blooming. It hasn't fully opened yet. We expect it to be fully open right around Wednesday.
So this is the first time it's bloomed in all these years?
It is, yes.
It doesn't give its blooms lightly, does it?
No, it doesn't. It has held out on us for 18 years now. So this is a pretty special time for us.
This plant has been at the gardens for 18 years. You know, that's as old as a high schooler. Does the staff get attached to a longtime plant like that?
Yes. I can attest to that personally. And those of us who have cared for that plant directly, we go in and check on her every day. And, we absolutely love our plants. We have a few plants here that people get attached to, you know, as staff and so on. And just because whether they're botanically really cool usually has a lot to do with it. And we're kind of all, you know, a bunch of plant geeks here, so... So, yeah, we do get attached.
And now we get to talk about why it's called a corpse flower. What happens when it blooms?
Well, what will happen is it will open up, and it will be quite wide, and it will be a maroon color inside, and it will smell of rotting flesh.
Which has led to your plant's name. And tell us your plant's name.
Mm-hmm. We have given her the pet name of Putricia, as in putrid.
So what causes that smell of rotting flesh?
Just like any flower will give off like a scent, this flower happens to produce a combination of chemicals that give off the scent of rotting flesh. And the reason that it does that is to attract pollinators that would be attracted to that smell. So things like flies and beetles and that sort of thing.
So Mother Nature is doing her thing and working beautifully.
Yeah. Picking a pollinator that maybe isn't quite so commonly used. Yeah.
What is Patricia's real name, her scientific name?
Morphophallus titanum.
And where do the corpse flowers actually come from?
They're native to Sumatra and Indonesia, usually in the higher elevations. But they're pretty rare in the wild these days.
Give me an idea of what this stinky bloom actually looks like. Is it a pretty bloom?
In my opinion, it's quite gorgeous. That deep maroon color that's in the center will be just really, it's just a really intense red. And then the outside edge that opens has like a frill, and so it's all kind of ruffled. And then the spadix that sticks up in the center is just enormous and has a really pretty, like, creamy color to it. So it's really quite gorgeous.
And how long would this bloom last?
At its peak, it will last only about 48 hours.
Wow. And then who knows how long until it blooms again?
Highly unpredictable. It could be anywhere from a couple of years to another 18.
So I guess anyone who wants a firsthand look and whiff of a blooming corpse flower, this is your week, and Frederick Meyer Gardens is the place to be. And what would you say the peak days would be?
I'm going to say our best guess right now, we're thinking will be Wednesday through Friday, maybe Thursday through Saturday. It'll be somewhere right in that window is what we're guessing. And we're keeping people updated on social media outlets and so on as well to be able to notify the public of, like, the, you know, most precise, stinkiest day.
Wendy, as a horticulturist, I'm wondering, does it feel to you as though different plants have different personalities?
Oh, 100%. Yes, absolutely.
So what's Patricia's?
I'd say Patricia is one of those kind of plants that's just going to take her sweet time. Like I said, we've had her for 18 years now, and corpse flowers can bloom from seedlings as early as 10 years. But Patricia, she wanted to be a good, healthy, full-size flower. So she's waited a bit, and she is doing her thing now. So.
Wendy Overbeck is with Frederick Meyer Gardens, where she's the Senior Horticultural Manager, here to bring us up to date on this week's blooming of their corpse flower, Patricia. Thank you so much for being with us, Wendy.
Well, thank you.
Coming up, we meet entrepreneur and musician Steffi James. Then, stories of Michigan boys who accomplished big things before turning 20.
You don't have to be an adult to accomplish something, that these 20 boys did what they did before they reached 20.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Her stage name is Steffi James. But friends and family here in Michigan know her best as Stephanie Hammoud. This Nashville-based singer-songwriter got her start playing gigs at a coffee shop her family opened near Detroit. And after years of touring with prominent bands, Steffi James is getting ready to release her debut album later this year. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has this preview.
The silver screen between the black and white, moving through the shadows like a streetcar on a ride.
Her music radiates with a sort of vintage atmosphere of the 60s with a little surf rock. James credits her mom for introducing her to musicals at a young age and says listening to show tunes shaped the way she thinks about songwriting.
I got into a lot of 60s stuff, like Roy Orbison records and Phil Spector records, and when I was really young, it was Bob Dylan. And once I heard Dylan, it was kind of like, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to write songs, and I don't know, I kind of go back to the roots, and like a lot of the musical theater stuff, it's really melodic. And I find myself writing melodies sometimes that are interesting, like not really typical for rock music or like rock and roll stuff. And I think a lot of that really comes from just I had different things in my ears growing up than a lot of other people do, I think.
In 2009, while in high school, James craved a place where she and friends could play music. At the same time, her family opened a small coffee shop called Dessert Oasis in Royal Oak. The idea was to bring the community together through sweets and live music. James would play almost every night for hours on end.
A lot of my friends played music as well, and we had no place to play. We didn't want to do the covers in bars. They also wouldn't let us in bars. We weren't 21, you know? So it was like kids would play guitar in parking lots after school and hang out. I thought that if we kind of made like a little place for it and just kind of built up that community, it's like a big thing for me, like artists supporting other artists. And so that was just what we did. We started promoting shows and putting on shows there and booking a lot of local Michigan acts who are still making incredible music and have passed through those doors at that coffee shop. It's very cool.
One night while James was on stage at her coffee shop, none other than 8-time Grammy-winning R&B legend Anita Baker walked in the door.
I knew who she was, you know, like right away, and I was so nervous. You're standing there and you're kind of like defenseless. Like I'm standing on the stage with my guitar and I'm like, oh, Anita Baker's here. Like, here we go, you know, and she's staring at me. Like she was sitting with some friends at a table, but she's watching me. And I was like, oh man, like don't mess up. And then afterwards, she was like, who are you? Like, where do you come from? Talk to me, you know? And so I did. I sat down and talked to her, and the shop had closed, you know, and the lights were off, and we were just sitting there for, like, hours after close, just talking, music, you know, everything.
Baker told James to consider taking her music career more seriously. And so James had a decision to make, stay in college at Oakland University or go on tour with Anita Baker.
And then when I got the call from Anita Baker to go on the road, it was like, there will always be like a classroom. I can always go get a degree, but like Anita Baker doesn't call every day and say, right, hey, like, come on the road. You know, I was like, I better do it. And so I just kind of jumped at that opportunity. And then once I was doing it, I just wanted to stay on the road. And I did. I traveled with her and we started in like New York City at Radio City Music Hall, which was unreal. You know, Bill O'Reilly was there. Like all of a sudden you're just around all these people and it's like, what is going on? But it's all very, very cool stuff. I fell in love with Nashville, the city. Yeah, it just kind of from there, it just took me down this other path.
James did not have a hard time finding work in Nashville. For a while, she worked with Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys. She toured with Nikki Lane and Michigan's own The Accidentals. Then she decided to focus on her own project. Earlier this year, James released a new single titled Silent Film.
Your call tonight, painting scenes across a cardboard screen, wearing the shirt you stowed in my bag the last time I left. Well, I woke up on my own again, beside a stranger in a pale blue room. I think of you. Untied shoes, I find the door.
That song was picked up by another Grammy winner, Michael Bolton, and released in conjunction with the premiere of Bolton's documentary film, American Dream Detroit, back in May. Now James is working with Alabama Shakes producer Andrea Tokic to debut her first solo album coming out at the end of the year. And in the middle of all of this newfound success, she and her family are still committed to supporting local artists. Dessert Oasis Coffee Roasters just opened a second location in downtown Detroit earlier this year.
Just a singer in a silent film, and the marquee is empty, set above the sidewalks where the children play. Frozen as a window pane, while a patron argues that Born to Run is some kind of poem, and I'm drinking from a paper.
Steffi James is playing at the Tip Top Deluxe in Grand Rapids on Wednesday, July 11th. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
In due time, I'll find my way back to you.
She brought us the stories of great girls in Michigan history. Well, now Patricia Major is focusing on the boys. Her latest book is Bold Boys in Michigan History, telling the stories of Michigan boys who did remarkable things before they were 20. Bold boys including a filmmaker, musicians, inventors, athletes, a politician, and more. Patricia Major, welcome back to Stateside. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
What is the common thread uniting these 20 boys in your book, beyond the fact that they lived in Michigan?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, the age group. There are so many books that have been written about adults, and maybe those have been written for children, but they're about the adult career. And I had been doing research for my previous book. I had noticed there were girls that had done things, and you know, before they even reached 20, and I thought, that's what we should talk about. That's more relatable to a child, you know, someone my age doing something amazing. Maybe I can too.
And even if it's someone we know very well for what they did in their adult mm-hmm. life, you've uncovered things that they did before they were 20 that mm-hmm. maybe we've never heard of. At whom are you aiming this book? What ages?
It's considered a middle school book, but I've had children, you know, as young as 6, either have it read to them by their parents or, you know, early readers can handle it too.
All right, so let's talk about some of the bold boys in Michigan history you have in your book. And we are all used to seeing photos of old white-haired Thomas Alva Edison, but you bring us a photograph of this young teen, Al Edison of Port Huron. And wow, that is a remarkably confident face, mm-hmm. just looking directly at that camera and smiling back at us. Mm-hmm. What did he do as a teenager?
Well, he actually began in the telegram business when telegrams were the main mode of communication. He also worked on the railroad that ran between Port Huron and Detroit, and he would sell things, you know, candy, cigarettes, mm-hmm. Newspapers.
And this is when he was like 13 or
yes,
so.
Okay. Yes,
He was
yes.
young.
Yeah, he came from a family that was certainly a lower end of the economic scale, and he really had to go out and work and help his father support the family. So he got that job on the railroad, and he also picked up the skills of being a telegrapher.
And because he had this smart idea when the Civil War broke mm-hmm. out. Tell us about that, because that goes to show that kind of innovative mindset that led him to become one of America's greatest innovators.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the people at home on the home front were starved for information during the Civil War. And he felt that if he could provide something more up to date than they were already getting, you know, he'd be able to sell that on his route back and forth between Port Huron and Detroit. So working with, at that point, he wasn't in the telegraph business himself, but he worked with an adult who was. He got the information from one stop about news, had it telegraphed to the next stop, and you know, that was about as up to date and fresh as you could get your news.
And so he sold more papers.
Right?
What an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and of course goes on to become the inventor of phonograph and light bulb and better batteries, and certainly very known. Let's go over to someone whose work will undoubtedly be familiar to the kids reading Bold Boys in Michigan History, and that's filmmaker Sam Raimi. Why did you choose mm-hmm. him?
I knew that he had loved films from a very young age and had done, in middle school, worked with some of his friends to create just little home movies. And they were always kind of daredevils, so they were, you know, doing crazy things or, you know,
gory things.
Yeah. And that's where he started as a serious filmmaker, was with gory things.
Yes.
But he had two friends that he worked with at that time, and they still continue to work together. But it's been a life of these three, you know, young boys who grew up in the Birmingham area, becoming multimillionaires and working in the film industry even today.
And of course, his first big film
Evil Dead.
Lots of gore.
Yes, yes. Starring Bruce Campbell.
Yes, his boyhood friend.
Right.
But of course, he really exploded to the world when he directed Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst in Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that you have arrived.
Yes, that was on a scale he had not experienced before. But between Evil Dead and Spider-Man, he really made an effort to school himself in different genres of film. So he wasn't sitting, you know, idly by waiting for the big mega movie to come his way. He really taught himself the business without a kind of traditional film school background.
You have a couple of very renowned athletes in your book, and we certainly know what they accomplished as men, but you have dug up interesting things about their early years. We'll start with Joe Louis. Tell us about his boyhood growing up in Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood.
Joe had actually grown up in the South, and he and his family fled the South because they were intimidated by the KKK. And a lot of Black families were coming north at that time to work in the auto factories and such. So it was a place to come. It was a place where you might meet your family again. And he grew up in that. His mother tried to keep him on the straight and narrow path by sending him off for violin lessons. Instead, he was sneaking out to go to a boxing ring, a boxing gym. And, you know, she continued to think he was doing the lessons and he was taking the money and paying for the boxing. So, you know, he became he was just a rising star. He was a superb athlete even as a young boy. So finally, you know, he had to admit to his mom what he was doing. But that money that he earned for that helped pay his family's way in Detroit.
I love the fact you tell your readers, Joe Louis, his first fight, he lost it, knocked down 7 times, and he got back up each and every time.
Yeah.
So you could see the makings of the man who would rewrite sports history. Mm-hmm. And then you bring us the story of Major League pitcher Jim Abbott of Flint.
Jim was one of my favorite stories in the book. He happens to be the first one because they're alphabetical, but he was born without a right hand. And his parents really did not let that hold him back. I mean, they encouraged him to do anything, try anything. And he loved sports. He was a very athletic kid, had good athletic skills. And so they got him into baseball. He won a local contest in terms of throwing the ball, you know, how far could you throw the ball. So he did quite well with his left hand. And then he, you know, worked his way through the little league and into high school where he was really a star pitcher at that point. And he was even drafted by the Blue Jays at that point in late high school. Mm-hmm. He chose to go to U of M. He stayed a couple of years, didn't finish his degree here, but he stayed a couple of years. And then that was sort of the platform from which he entered Major League Baseball.
Into the bigs.
Yep.
And certainly known. You bring us in your book, Bold Boys in Michigan History, Patricia, you bring us the story of a very musically precocious Detroit boy named John Gillis, who the world now knows as
Jack White.
What is his boyhood story?
Jack was born into a big Catholic family. He was the 10th kid. You know, they weren't well-to-do, but what they did together. And his brothers and sisters played different musical instruments, and they were sort of passed down to him. So he learned at a very early age a multitude of instruments, much like Stevie Wonder did. His big boyhood musical idol was Bob Dylan, which is surprising because you don't think of Jack White's music as folk, but that was sort of his guiding light. He said, I had 3 men in my life, my father, God, and Bob Dylan. You know, those are my idols, you know. So that was where he got his, you know, his interest in writing, his way of performing, his musical sense from observing, playing with his family, just being precocious in that way.
From a very early age. Yeah. And as you tell us, as he became famous and made his way in musical on the musical scene, he actually had a chance to work with Bob Dylan, which was pretty amazing. And of course, you could not write about Bold Boys in Michigan history without talking about Stevie Hardaway Judkins, Stevie Wonder.
Yep.
And he was how old when he was discovered and started, when he actually began playing at a younger age, didn't
he? Right. He was another one of those children who was exposed to a lot of instruments in terms of being signed, you know, in a formal way. He was signed by Motown at 10, and he was part of a duo. Unfortunately for the other boy, he kind of drifted off, and I think he did other work at Motown, but Stevie really became the focus, and he just launched from there. And he, you know, he started in Saginaw, but moved to Detroit with his family, and he had just the phenomenal musical abilities. He could just pick up instruments and learn them, and he was an incredible writer. I mean, that's, you know, something I think we probably don't give him enough credit for. He was an incredible songwriter, wrote for himself and other Motown artists. You know, he was definitely one of the shining stars of Motown.
Your book
and still is.
Your book, he certainly is. And your book really is striking in that it takes us through the ages. We really do track through early history. Mm-hmm. Even you have a Native American leader. You have the boy governor of Michigan, mm-hmm. Stevens Mason. So many interesting bold boys. What character traits do you think, despite the era they grew up in, what character traits did you get a sense that they shared?
Well, they definitely were go-getters. And one thing I did find interesting, and this compares to my previous book, Great Girls, their fathers were very key to their development. Either their fathers were negative figures, like they abandoned the family, or they were sort of, you know, couldn't make a living and the family was destitute and the boys stepped in. And on the girls' side, the fathers were key figures because the mothers were working in more traditional roles and they weren't someone you necessarily aspired to be because they didn't have the kind of career that some of those girls wanted. The girls were inspired by their fathers in a positive way, and some of the boys were too, but there were other boys that were inspired by the negative example their fathers set.
What do you hope that young readers will take away from this book?
Well, definitely that you don't have to be an adult to accomplish something, that these 20 girls and 20 boys did what they did before they reached 20. And they sometimes carried that career on, and sometimes we lose them in history. But the important thing is you don't have to wait until you're out of high school or out of college or whatever to make a difference, because these kids did it quite young.
Patricia Major's newest book, Bold Boys in Michigan History, a companion book to her earlier work, Great Girls in Michigan History. What a pleasure, Patricia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, some high school grads in West Michigan are taking their next step with careers in manufacturing. And then, could recycling steel and aluminum help cushion us from tariffs and trade wars? That's all coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Manufacturers in Michigan are pushing out this message to high school graduates that heading straight into a four-year college program is not the only path to a successful life with a well-paying job. A West Michigan effort called Discover Manufacturing is a way for manufacturers to show students, schools, and community colleges just what they can offer. In other words, close the talent gap and get rid of the old stereotypes of a factory job. With us now is Jay Dunwell, president of Wolverine Coil Spring Company in Grand Rapids. Jay, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we are happy to welcome Junior Aguilar. He's a setup technician at Wolverine Coil Spring and a graduate of Union High School in Grand Rapids. Junior, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Jay, for anyone who went through the Great Recession in this state, there is a very persistent memory, basically people being laid off from the kinds of manufacturing and factory jobs that their parents and grandparents had held. So there were pink slips and factories closing and jobs going to Mexico, going south. Is that a fair take on those lost years, do you think?
Well, there certainly was a significant transition in the manufacturing sector throughout that recession. But in today's manufacturing, it's such a different world that if parents, students, the community thinks that manufacturing is stagnant and the old dark, dirty, dingy, dead-end career paths that it may have once been, that has certainly changed. And we're hopeful that our efforts to expose students to these new careers and the true advanced manufacturing that exists in our state today is something that will help change that perception.
I saw one statistic that there will be well over 800,000 job openings in our state between now and 2024. This is this talent gap. How much of this is because baby boomers are retiring?
It's a big factor. We love to do the demographics of our community as well as our individual companies. And it's kind of daunting how many baby boomers are nearing that retirement stage. And as we grow, manufacturing is quite healthy now. That need to be more and more productive is ever present, but we're not gonna solve it with entirely productivity improvements. We're going to need to attract talent and dislocated workers to the manufacturing sector.
So as you go around and you talk with students or you meet people in schools, counselors, teachers, what are some of the misconceptions that you are hearing about manufacturing and its jobs?
Well, I think the biggest one is that it's low tech and that the work environment is unattractive. The technology used even in our little spring manufacturing company is pretty phenomenal. We enjoy bringing bus tours or bringing our equipment to events where lots of students might be gathering just so they can see, really, that's how you bend wire into whatever shape an engineer might invent to facilitate his purposes. And so the technology, I think, is one of the big perceptions that needs to be changed in the community. And when they see the work environment, that it's bright and the floors are clean and the air doesn't smell, and there's groups of folks that are really using problem solving and their minds, not just their muscles, to solve problems and produce product, I think that's a whole different manufacturing environment than they're used to.
And so this effort, Discover Manufacturing, is a part of West Michigan Works. So how does this help with this mission? What are you doing in Discover Manufacturing to kind of basically sell manufacturing to prospective employees?
The state and the federal government both said, you know what, manufacturing is very important to our economies of both state and federal levels. And so when Governor Snyder said, instead of West Michigan Works being focused on dislocated workers, but to focus more on the employers and the employers' talent needs, West Michigan Works came to a group of manufacturers that have been getting together for years under the Right Place and our Manufacturers Council. And West Michigan Works said, you know, Jay, if you could organize your committee more regionally, you might be able to do a whole lot more than just as a small Kent County effort. And since then, we've been trying to do basically three things: promote our industry, utilize better training with our training partners, whether it's the curriculum or the capacity of the training programs, as well as just outreach and connection and communication throughout the region.
So you are really speaking directly to talent and saying, come see what we have to offer. Junior, how did you end up working at Wolverine Coil Spring?
I actually took a tour. My school, Union High School, they gave us the opportunity to come into Wolverine and take a tour of the place. And then that same day, they gave us sheets to fill out and applications if we wanted to take this opportunity to come back. And I did that, and here I am still 3 years, right after high school, 3 years still going.
Here you are, you're in high school. Before you went on this tour and you actually were there at Wolverine and you saw it in action, what did you think working in a factory was like, Junior?
I've always heard it was just a basic, you know, you're standing in one spot doing the same thing all day, whereas here you're not. It's always a lot of hands-on work, which me personally, I like a lot. Challenging as well, which I like a lot too. Keeps me busy throughout the day. Not always are the, you know, the machines are not always running perfect, so you got to fine-tune them here and there, which takes up time as well, and that's what I like most about it.
Kind of that troubleshooting and solving problems.
Yeah, exactly.
When you think of the kinds of jobs that you're saying, Jay Dunwell, are out there, and that there will be all these job openings between now and 2024, what kinds of jobs are we talking about, and how do they pay?
There's a significant transition from, you know, the manual, using your muscles as opposed to your mind type work. And I think that's just going to continue. The technology that's implemented in today's manufacturing is really where we need the talent to focus. So it's the folks that can handle CNC programming. It's the folks that can understand programmable logic controls. And this whole world of mechatronics is, you know, quickly emerging. So I think the pay for the entry-level position is going to keep going up and up because the skill set required of those entry-level positions is going to continue to go up and up. And with the, you know, supply and demand curves of talent, the starting wages continue to go up and up.
You know, you and other manufacturing executives, Jay, are going through efforts like Discover Manufacturing. So you are reaching out to students like Junior, bringing him in and letting him see what it's like. You're reaching out to parents, teachers, and counselors with this message. Manufacturing is not what you think it is. It's not what it used to be. But what's at stake if you don't get more people going into skilled trades?
Well, the challenge will be to continue to automate. You know, there are a lot of businesses that think, you know, we're going to drive direct labor as low as we possibly can just to survive in the talent market we're currently in. You know, Wolverine continues to make efforts to enhance automation. We have a lot of fun with students when they walk into our plant and they see one particular very simplistic way of automating something. A product will fall out of a stress-relieving oven into a tote, and that tote is attached to it's basically like a slide that you might see on a playground, but there's a magnetic conveyor underneath the slide, and it picks up a spring and carries it from beneath the stress-relieving oven up this slide and dumps it into a barrel. Years ago, would have staff people pick up baskets of springs and put them into these barrels. Well, you know, we're gonna save every minute of labor that we possibly can by investing in very simple but effective ways to help be more productive. So the talent need just continues to grow on the technical side of things, the problem-solving things, the soft skills of responsibility and teamwork type stuff.
How successful in West Michigan has Discover Manufacturing been, do you think, in this outreach effort?
Well, I'm very proud of some of the projects that Discover Manufacturing has been a part of. The most key project has been the My Career Quest event that's been held the last 4 years in DeVos Place. This past spring, we had over 9,000 students come through in one day, exploring careers in manufacturing, construction, IT, and healthcare. And if you can imagine 700 and some odd students coming at you every 24 minutes and you need to expose them to the excitement of your career opportunities in your particular industry, that's a lot of fun. And that's gotten a lot of, sells out like a rock concert. The demand is so strong. Manufacturing Week is a big push in early October to open up doors to manufacturing facilities. And in the past year, we had over 7,000 students visit over 166 manufacturers. Our hope is to have over 8,000 this coming October. So, you know, those are the efforts to say, hey, we are a different industry than we used to be. Come check it out. Come see for yourself.
Jay Dunwell, Junior Aguilar with Wolverine Coil Spring Company, talking about Discover Manufacturing. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Last Friday, President Trump's first tariffs hit $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. Beijing responded quickly with its own tariffs on equal amounts of U.S.-made goods. In other words, the trade war is on. One of the key targets of the Trump tariffs is imported steel and aluminum. But would tariffs and trade wars matter as much if we did a better job recycling scrap metal? Let's find out as we welcome Dan Cooper, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Michigan. Dan, you've spent 8 years researching just how to make the steel and aluminum industry more efficient. What pointed you in that direction?
So what I noticed was that the U.S. does import a tremendous amount of metal, 36 million tons of steel, nearly 5 million tons of aluminum. And what I was doing was I looked at how much the U.S. was recycling, and I noticed that the amount the U.S. fails to recycle internally is about equal to the amount it imports. So we're importing an awful lot of expensive metal and exporting a lot of cheap metal.
Interesting. And I know that you wrote a piece in The Conversation, and you tell us the U.S. made 82 million metric tons of steel last year. That's enough to circle the globe 8 times. And 68% of that was made from scrap metal, which seems like a healthy percentage, no? But could we be doing better?
We could. It's difficult to have an exact figure, but we estimate that no more than 2/3 of all of the worn steel and aluminum goods that we discard are actually recycled. The rest either goes to landfill or are exported.
So your view is we could cut way back on how much metal we're importing and perhaps avoiding these new tariffs if we did a better job of recycling our metal.
Absolutely.
And so if you look at that, moving to recycling instead of importing, that could have economic impact. And also, what kind of environmental impact could it have?
This could have very significant environmental impacts. So making steel and aluminum is tremendously environmentally harmful. 10% of all of the world's emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, come from making steel and aluminum. But if we recycle rather than making them from ore, what we dig out of the ground, if we instead recycle, that has a much smaller carbon footprint. The greenhouse gas emissions for recycling steel are around 1/4 of what they are for making new steel, and recycling aluminum cuts emissions by more than 80%.
And if we're not mining iron ore and bauxite, that's also better for the environment.
Absolutely. Lots of environmental damage is done with the mining.
When you think of steel and aluminum recycled and used in the U.S., how much or what percent of the steel and aluminum that we use in this country is recycled?
No more than 2/3 of the steel and aluminum that we discard is actually recycled.
And the rest, as you say, is going into landfills, just being junked?
Yes, absolutely.
So what do we do to change? How do we go about doing a better job of recycling?
Well, there's both an economic and a technical challenge. So if scrap metal is worth more, we do tend to collect more. The invisible hand works like that. But there is a technical challenge too. The scrap dealers have these big piles of scrap metal, but they're not all just one pure type of metal. They get mixed up, and that really decreases the value of the scrap. And so either we recycle it into low-value products, or we export it, and often up until now to China, where they have separated it by hand.
So they're doing the separating, and then it's coming back here. And now
it's a much more expensive import.
At what point in the process of recycling would that sorting out actually be most advantageous?
Well, there are two different approaches. We could encourage manufacturers to make products which are easier to recycle, to make it easier for the steel in your car to be separated from the copper. Or we could encourage more investment in scrap separation technologies that the scrap dealers themselves can use.
So it's just been very easy for us as a nation to not address this. To say, hey, 2/3, we're doing well, but you're saying we can do a lot better.
Yes, and we've also been able to export a lot to China, but China is now going to be imposing tariffs on U.S. exports of scrap. So we are left with either sending more of our scrap metal to landfill or finding a way to make use of all that scrap metal.
What kind of support or help can the government offer, should the government offer, to make this more a goal that we could realize?
I think there are lots of opportunities for improving scrap separation technologies. Many of them exist, but they are expensive at the moment, and they could be improved. And I think there is both a research element to this for universities, but also maybe tax breaks and subsidies for those scrap dealers that are investing in these latest technologies.
Is there anything consumers should be doing at the home level to help this process?
Well, recycling as much as you can is great as a consumer, but an awful lot of our metal isn't necessarily what you would think of as a consumer good. A lot of it is in buildings, in infrastructure, in your car. Not very easy products necessarily to just take to the bottle bank.
So what's the step to do that then? That's calling on industry and calling on business to be a part of this as well?
Absolutely. And I know that the scrap dealers that I've spoken to are really wanting to work with government to be able to recycle into higher value products to be able to keep the metal within the U.S.
So looking ahead and thinking of the work you've done and where it could go, how much do you believe that more and better recycling would help to cushion our industries like the auto industry from tariffs and trade wars?
Well, as I say, the amount we are failing to recycle is about the same as the amount that we are importing. So if we were able to really step up our recycling, I think we could put a big dent into the amount that we have to import. And so we'd be able to both lower imports and be able to provide good metal to our manufacturers.
Food for thought. Dan Cooper, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Michigan. You can read more on this and find his piece on recycling more steel and aluminum by going to theconversation.com. What's the next question you want to tackle with your research?
Something I'm particularly interested in is how different products that we are making is going to influence the amount that we can recycle. As we make more and more electric vehicles, there are some big challenges there in terms of how we recycle the new materials that are going into those types of cars rather than the current ones.
Dan Cooper, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Today's program was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.